Utah Public Radio would like to thank this year's sponsors of our 2014 legislative coverage, AARP Utah and Utah State University Center for Women and Gender.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Well, the 2014 Utah legislature closed last night. Medicaid expansion, air quality, education, the budget. These are just some of the topics we're going to talk about today on Access Utah. Our guests include Governor Gary Herbert, House Speaker Rebecca Lockhart, House Minority Assistant Whip Rebecca Chavez-Hauk, Senate Majority Assistant Whip Pete Knudsen, and Senate Minority Leader Gene Davis. We want to know what you think as well. What happened to the bills you were following? Are you pleased? Your chance to talk to state leaders about the important issues of the day. Here's how you can reach us during the hour. You can direct your questions or comments to upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. You can comment on our Utah Public Radio Facebook page, look for the picture of the Utah State Capitol, and you can call 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. We begin with my conversation from yesterday evening with Governor Gary Herbert, who was not able to join us this morning. Here's that conversation. I want to start with Medicaid expansion, Governor. You have a proposal, of course, on the table. A couple in the legislature. I believe one has passed out of the Senate, and it looks like it's not going to pass the House. Let's say nothing passes out of the legislature. What are you going to do? What's your next step?
Well, my first request to the legislature was to not tie my hands. And so that's not happening. My hands aren't being tied. And the Senate really has embraced, in fact, my proposal. So they're supportive. The Speaker of the House of Representatives has said, you know, I don't need permission. I can go back and negotiate the best deal I can with the Obama administration. So she's at least acknowledged that. They've not let the Senate bill come up for a vote. But I do believe that there's many members of the body in the House of Representatives that would support my proposal on a block grant approach as an alternative to Medicaid expansion. And so I feel good about where I'm at, frankly, and I think that we can go back, and I'm working with a number of other governors I've already talked to. We have our team leaving. We'll be there Monday in Washington, D.C. to start moving ahead with the negotiations and see if we can't get the appropriate agreements on a healthy Utah plan. I think, one, we're going to, with the Healthy Utah Plan, we can actually be more effective in helping people. I think we'll have a better program than the typical Medicaid expansion, and it respects the taxpayers' dollars, and I think that all around on many levels, this is going to be a better alternative to just full-blown Medicaid expansion.
What would you like to see, the best-case scenario, how many people additionally covered, how much money?
Just to recap, and I know you probably know this, Tom, but we send back as Utah taxpayers under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, about $680 million. They will give back to us, as per the law, $258 million of that to put into Medicaid expansion, so-called. I'm just saying, let's take the $258 million and rather than put it into Medicaid expansion, put it into our own program called Healthy Utah, similar to what they do in Indiana, which they have a Healthy Indiana plan, similar to what they're doing in Arkansas, where the money's all being put into insurance programs, similar to what Tennessee wants to do and other states that I'm working with. So the intent is to take the money and still serve the same group of people. That's people that go up to 133% of poverty, and in Utah, that's about 111,000 people. And so it's kind of the same group, but just a different way to serve them. We're going to have more skin in the game from the recipient. They're going to pay some of the premium, those that can afford it, at least 2% of their income, those above 100% of poverty. There will be co-payments. There's going to be better service, better doctors. I think we'll have a better outcome all around and get better bang for the taxpayers' dollars in serving those 111,000 people than we would with just a typical Medicaid program.
Talk me through the process here, if you would, Governor. So you go negotiate the best deal you can with the Obama administration. You come back, and then that would need to be approved by a special session of the legislature?
Yes. I can go negotiate the agreements on this. I don't think I need any permission, really, from the legislature. Where the legislature does get involved, of course, I want to have their support and their buy-in. I want to have a consensus, not some kind of confrontation. But where they do have a role to play is when we put $258 million into the budget, under our current statutes, they have the ability to take a look at that before they accept the money. So they could, I guess, say, well, we don't like the program and we're not going to take the money and stop that from happening. But that would be an interesting discussion, certainly with the public at large, saying, what? You're not taking our money back? And so that will be the process. I first need to go. It's going to take probably 2 to 4 months, I think, to get this all agreed to. And it literally will be a kind of an agreement, a contract with the Department of Health. Then with that done, bring it back. We would vet it with the legislature, the leadership, individual legislators, then call a special session to actually have a mechanism to accept the money and put it into the budget.
Looking at the politics of this, of course you're aware of this, some Republicans especially don't want to have anything to do with Obamacare and don't want to take federal money, even if it were in the block grant form. Do you think you can overcome those objections?
Well, I think the more people think about it, the more common sense prevails. It's like if I gave you $50 and you say, well, you've overpaid me, and I'll give you $20 back, and I say, no, you just keep it. You know, that's part of what we're doing. This is not money that we're borrowing from China. This does not help balance the federal budget and their deficit. This is money that we're being collected right now today from our companies here in Utah, our medical device companies, our Merit Medicals, our Edward Life Sciences, our Preseniuses. It's from our suntanning tax that comes from the suntanning beds that people utilize and others. We send $680 million. And for us to not take part of that back that's being given to us, which will be spent other ways in other places, seems to be a little bit unwise. So, yeah, we've got to have that discussion, that debate. And the question ultimately is going to be, would you rather have the federal government spend the $280 million? Or would you rather have Utah spend the money? To me, that's a no-brainer. We will spend it more efficiently and more effectively and get better outcomes. I would just assume Utah spend more of the money. I just assume we didn't send money back to Washington, D.C. in the first place, other than for some limited needs like public safety and national defense and some issues like that. But I just assume have it stay here at home. But when they do take it, I just assume they give it back to us in a block grant form, because we can spend it much better and get a better outcome, and the taxpayers are better served. In fact, we could probably, if we do that, have some tax cuts. So it's better than just leaving it out there and having the federal government spend it inappropriately.
One of the objections I heard, or concerns, this better said, was expressed on this program a couple of weeks ago by Representative Ed Redd from up here in Logan. He said while he is sympathetic, he's concerned with setting up a program at a certain level, and then he's concerned we may not be able to sustain that down the road if we have a downturn in the economy, for example.
Well, two things come to mind. One, that's why it's a pilot program. It's a 3-year pilot program. We're going to ask the Department of Health here in our own state to monitor it to see what the results are with individuals and families. Are we really helping people or not? And secondly, to monitor the federal government. Are they willing and able to keep their commitments, which is what you just talked about? And three, how does it impact our own state budget? So it's a pilot program that we'll be able to take a look at after 3 years of data collection and say, well, here's where it's working well, here's where it's not, here's what improvements need to be made, here's where we have some problems, we should go for it, or we should get out. But as Representative Redd, as a medical doctor, would understand, just because you may not be able to service people in 3 years and help people as a doctor doesn't mean you don't help people today that you're capable of doing. I think that would be, again, foolish. I can help people today. It may be that I can't help them in 3 years because of circumstances, whatever they end up being, but that doesn't mean, well, because I can't help you in 3 years, I won't help you today. That seems to be a little bit wrong-headed. So that's why it's a pilot program. That's why we're going to do thorough analysis on our budget, the federal government's commitment, and making sure that we're really helping people. And we'll see where it goes from there. But I'm very confident, just like we've had Medicaid in place since their late 60s, by the way, the federal government's not defaulted on any of their portion of the payment, which has been a 70-30 split. for that many years. Maybe that's a worry out there, and certainly a concern that they're not spending their money rationally in Washington. But that shouldn't stop us in this particular instance of spending our own money and saying, look, it's our money. Let us spend it, because we'll spend it much better than you. And if we can't do it in 3 years, we'll have to pull the plug on it. That's just the reality. That's a tough decision that politicians sometimes have to make. We did it during the recession. We had to cut $1 billion out of our budget during the Great Recession, and we did it. We made the tough decisions. You live within your means. You do what you can, but you do what you can.
We're talking with Governor Gary Herbert, Utah governor, on the program today on the occasion of the wrapping up of the 2014 legislative session. I want to move to air quality, Governor. A lot of bills introduced, a lot of interest at the beginning of the legislative session. This winter has, thankfully, been a little better in terms of the weather with air quality. What are you seeing coming out of the legislature? Are you satisfied with that? What are the principles you're looking at going forward on this?
Well, you said it correctly, Tom, that the biggest single factor about air quality is, our weather. And if we have inversions, we have a problem. If we don't have inversions, it's a beautiful day outside. So we'll have less inversions this year than we had last year, and the volume of pollutants in the air during those inversions will be less, too. Some think maybe by half. We are doing everything we can to clean up the air. I mean, it's a legitimate issue. It's not only just a health care issue, but it is economic development. People are going to be reluctant to come here over time if we don't have a good environment, a good clean air, and those things that go along with quality of life. So it's an issue that's, I think, resonating with the legislature more than ever before. That being said, a lot of the stuff we're doing to clean up the air is just stuff we're doing. I don't need legislative approval or buy-in or bills being passed, stopping wood burning, whether it be in fireplaces or stoves, is something we're going to do through the Division of Environmental Quality. We are going to move towards Tier 3 fuels, cleaner fuels, and automobiles as quick as we can. Again, tailpipes is a big part of our emissions and pollutants during inversion, so that's a big step in the right direction. We're already engaged with industry as far as making sure they have best available technology so that their pollution levels are going down and will, in fact, continue to go down over time. We want to make sure that we meet the requirements of the Clean Air Act in 2019. Now that they're tightening that down, it used to be PM10 that we had to reduce particulates. Now it's PM2.5. Much more stringent, much more difficult to meet those. But we are on a glide path to reach those requirements under the Clean Air Act. Areas where we could do better, I've asked for money for replacement of our school buses. Our buses, some of them are 30 years old, and we can improve the environment, at least the tailpipe emissions, by new buses by about 90% of what they're doing now. So it's a big step in the right direction. That has not been funded as of yet. Maybe that will happen before the session's over today. There's another bill that gives us more flexibility to have the state say where we need it to be more difficult, more tough, and have stricter standards than what is required under the Clean Air Act. And I don't like the one-size-fits-all that comes out of Washington. This is an example of maybe we need to be a little more strict in the federal requirements to address our unique situation here. That being said, I think we're doing some good things for air quality. We're going to do some even greater things. What we don't get done in this legislative session, we'll come back and tackle in the next legislative session.
We'll talk about Count My Vote, the compromise that was forged, Senator Bramble's Senate Bill 54, which you have signed, I believe, which to review briefly, of course, you know this, Governor, it preserves convention Cox convention system, adds a path to primary by signatures, and mandates open primaries. So what do you think this is going, what effect do you think this is going to have?
Well, I think it's a compromise. Probably both sides of the issue are not too happy, but both of them had issues going forward. Some of it's litigation issues, some of it was just whether the public supported your point of view or that point of view. And I was concerned about the overreach of the legislature and not only telling parties what to do and how to do it. I think that's a significant issue. But I was also concerned about the perception of the legislature gaming the system and taking away the voice of the people through their initiative petition process by presupposing what the outcome is going to do and then countermanding that outcome. So I encouraged them to find a compromise where they could come together, and by golly, they did. I've heard the arguments in detail here. I was with the Republican Central Committee here just a couple of weeks ago and heard Representative Dan McKay and Senator Kurt Bramble argue why they thought this was a good thing, and they've got persuasive arguments about this being a good compromise. And it's not black and white. I can argue both sides. But I think this compromise is a good place to be, and it does preserve the convention caucus system, which I'm a big fan of and a big supporter of. And it does provide an alternative route for those who want to go that extra effort. For me, that's 28,000 signatures I've got to go gather. For me, it's actually easier, I think, to go through the caucus convention system. But for those who don't like that and want to try another way, they can get on the ballot too. So it is, in the true sense of the word, a compromise. It's not perfect, but that's why I signed it. And I think they dealt in good faith. I think they came up with a pretty good compromise.
Do you think this was at heart about ideology, people's fears of people getting nominated who are perhaps not representative of the entire party?
That was part of the argument for some. I don't know if it's necessarily a legitimate argument. I think there is some legitimacy to it in different areas, and you can always have this anecdotal story that proves the point. But it doesn't mean that's generally how it is. We've had, through this caucus system, we've had some pretty moderate people that get elected as governor. Mike Leavitt, and Olin Walker, John Huntsman Jr., pretty moderate people. And the finalists, Nolan Karras, a real moderate, good Republican, was in the finals against John Huntsman when he ran for governor. So the caucus convention system has not produced these wide-eyed, radical right-wingers, at least for governor. So, again, there may be some legitimacy. I've always said that this is about participation. The debate should be about getting more people involved, and I think the convention caucus system works really well if people show up. Mm-hmm. If you don't show up, if there's only five of you that show up in the living room, it could be that there are four radicals there. It could be radical left or radical right. If you get 50 people to show up, chances are you're going to find an election where you have kind of mainstream Republican Democrats that really do represent the neighborhoods, and then you've got a good delegate base that will make the right decisions. And I believe in representative form of government, and this is just the ultimate grassroots representative form of government. Again, a general population election for a primary, it has its own flaws in it. And again, I can speak as somebody that probably doesn't matter to me for my reelection whether I go general primary or do the convention caucus system. But general primary certainly lends itself to more name recognition and more money, and that's not altogether good. May not be altogether bad, but it's just different. So, I think the compromise is good. What it will do long term, we'll have to wait and see.
We're 2 years away. Are you in for sure, Governor, for 2016?
I've got to meet with my family, my wife, to make that decision. I think that I've got to decide here sometime this year. We've still got elections this year to completed. So I don't want to trip over what's already going on with other elections that are already in cycle. But certainly I've got to make a decision by the end of this year so that I can get in cycle for the next 2 years. And so I expect I'll have some kind of family time and with the current First Lady and see if I can get her blessing and with my family members. It's a hard, rewarding job, but it's difficult, and it's certainly some sacrifice on the family's part. And I clearly have enjoyed what we're doing. I feel good about the accomplishments. My gosh, we're just such a blessed state for the great results we're getting. And I'm leaning towards that direction, but I've got to make sure that my family's okay before I make any kind of an announcement.
Governor Gary Herbert, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Appreciate it. Governor Herbert was not able to join us this morning, so that's my conversation with him from last evening. Looking ahead to 2016 already, Speaker Lockhart is rumored to be interested in a run for governor. I believe Senator Niederhauser has announced that he's in. And the process, at least immediately, gets started next week with caucuses. and there'll be a change to the system with Senate Bill 54. We're going to be talking more about Medicaid expansion, air quality, education, the budget, other issues, looking back at the 2014 Utah legislative session. Later in the program, Speaker of the House, Rebecca Lockhart, House Minority Assistant Whip, Rebecca Chavez-Houck. Immediately following the break, which is next, we'll have Senate leaders, Senate Minority Leader Gene Davis and Senate Majority Assistant Whip Peter Knudsen. And your call to 1-800-826-1495 is welcome, or you can reach us by email to upraxcess@gmail.com. More following the break.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I featured the distinctive voice of Will Kimbrough and the debut release from the 20-year-old Parker Millsap. I'll also play tracks from new albums by David Crosby, the John Butler Trio, and Patty Griffin, among other talented artists. Join me this Saturday at 8 p.m. for Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Open Monday through Saturday until 3, offering 100% whole grain raisin, oatmeal date, and millet breads. Support also comes from Culligan Water of Cache Valley, family-owned and operated for more than 62 years, providing Culligan bottled water, salt delivery, or soft and conditioned water. Hey Culligan Man, service from the man in blue, online at logan.culliganman.com.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. We're recapping the 2014 Utah legislative session, which closed last night. And we appreciate the gentleman who joined us now had a late night last night, I assume, and are willing to join us this morning somewhat early, especially given the late night last night. We welcome in Senate Minority Leader Gene Davis. Thanks for joining us for the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And Senate Majority Assistant Whip Peter Knudsen, thanks for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
Let me start with you, Senator Davis. I want to start with the Medicaid expansion. What did you think of what happened? Essentially, nothing happened. But the governor did say he got what he wanted, at least in part. Didn't get his hands tied. He's now going to go negotiate. Looks like a special session. What do you think the prospects of getting Medicaid expansion passed?
I'm kind of disappointed that we didn't move forward with a commitment from the legislature. But the governor does have the ability to go and negotiate and bring it back to the legislature and present to us what he wants. I'm hoping that in his negotiations that we remember the thousands of people, tens of thousands of people here in the state of Utah that don't have access to health care.
And Senator Davis, I believe you ran a bill which would have provided for a pretty expansive expansion of Medicaid.
Yes, total expansion, which would have been the monies for the next 3 years at least would have been monies that came back to us 100% from the federal government to cover up to 138% of poverty. And also after that would have been about a 10% cost to the state. I think the one thing is we keep talking about Medicaid expansion as just being coverage for poor people, and that is true. But we know that our Medicaid rolls expand tremendously during downturns in the economy. And what this will do is provide people who lose their jobs for downturns in the economy the ability to continue to have health care access.
Senator Knudsen, what do you think the prospects are? Well, first of all, what do you think what happened, and do you have concerns about Medicaid expansion?
Well, you know, this is not an issue that just suddenly dropped on our laps. I've served on the task force dealing with the health care issues, and this particular issue, Medicaid expansion, we started talking about that 2 years ago. Our biggest concern from the majority side of the aisle is that if in 2 years the federal government decides to pull the plug, then the state is on the line for continuing that program without the federal dollars at the level that we could receive at this point. So it's an issue that has had a lot of debate. And I guess if I were to characterize it, if we had a clearer picture beyond the next 2 years, I think we could come to an agreement very quickly. But we can't, and so we'll continue to look at this issue. I know the governor is very anxious to do something good for these folks that truly need assistance. With the expansion to 138% of poverty, not all who qualify are truly needy. I'm not saying that they're wealthy. I'm not saying that they're in a snug middle-class position. But they are capable of getting a job that perhaps might even offer benefits, such as health care insurance. So, you know, these are the issues that we have to look at, try to get the emotion off the table, and look at it from a fiscal responsibility as well as a way of covering people who truly need it.
Senator Davis, do you think something less than 138% of poverty is likely, given some of the concerns raised by Senator Knudsen, which I'm sure are shared by others?
You know, I think having the ability to access affordable health care is probably a paramount concern of everyone. We've seen, in my experiences, watching families who have been trying to get on Medicaid or children of their children are on Medicaid. These are people who could be climbing the economic ladder in the state of Utah, but due to the fact of heavy illness or disease in a family member, it forces them to just to be able to afford the care. It forces them into poverty in many ways and prohibits them from growing, because the program is designed only at 100% of poverty, and so there's no ladder for them to climb out economically and be able to find the resources that they need to take care of their family member. Mm. And that's one of the basic ideas behind the ACA.
We're talking with Senator Gene Davis, Senate Minority Leader, and Senator Peter Knudsen, who is the Assistant Majority Whip. And later on the program, we'll have House leaders. We're recapping the 2014 session of the Utah Legislature. Senators, air quality has been a big topic, especially among our listeners. The received less urgency since we've had a better winter. So thankful for that. But at the beginning of the legislative session, there were rallies and many bills introduced, starting with Senator Davis again. Are you satisfied with what came out of the session in terms of air quality?
You know, it was interesting. We came in during those dark, really dirty days in January. And as one rural senator pointed out to me, gosh, take a look outside. Look at that air today. It's clean. Maybe we did something right. Anyway, that was just a lament
from one
of those senators. But I think the thing that we did do, as I look at my list real quick, like, is we passed about four of about 20 clean air bills. Resource stewardship amendments create state job to push government for air quality improvements. We passed a bill for funding for heavy-duty diesel retrofits and encourages the replacement of landscaping maintenance and other equipment, your lawnmower. Energy-efficient tax credits for vehicles, boost tax credits for the purchases to $2,500, that passed. Wood-burning amendments, it gives the Department of Air Quality funding for educating the public and to convert some homes to cleaner natural gas. Those are some of the bills that did pass. Unfortunately, we did not deal with the chilling aspect of the part where we are tied to the federal on and can't really get to those more stringent laws above and beyond what the federal laws are. That continues to be a source of chilling effect on being able to find a Utah solution for cleaner air. The amendments to the transportation funding, which would have allowed cities and counties to ask the voters for an increase in sales tax to pay for mass transit projects, such as purchasing buses. And it was not to increase any more rail, but it was designed to purchase more buses and get more inter-neighborhood or inter-community transportation going.
Senator Knutson, similar question to you. Are you satisfied with what came out of the session today, and do you think that will meet your constituents' needs?
Well, you know, there were 15 proposed bills which dealt with air quality, and there was a lot of ongoing debate throughout the legislative session. I think the bottom line is there's a growing reality that there are things that we as a state government can do, but there's also a great deal that we as individual citizens can do without having to have the government mandate it. And those are clearly outlined from many different sources. So, you know, it's the old adage, you want to change the world, well, start with yourself. And I think that's true when it comes to clean air measures. But to assume that if we were to be able to expand our regulation beyond what the federal government does, talk about chilling effects based on past performance of the federal government, and of course the expansion of Medicaid is a keen example of it. You have to be cautious, and obviously we are cautious in Utah. There's no question about it. But you know, over the years, and the governor has talked about this continuously, is that 10 years ago, our problem was a lot worse than it is today. And I'm not saying, see, we're okay. That isn't what I'm saying. I'm saying that the public has become more aware, and it continues to be even more aware every day. And I think we need to continue along the trail that we started this session, and I suspect we will see some improvements. If I might, I'd like to go back to that Medicaid expansion issue, because there's a point that was not made that I think needs to be made. And that is this, that even though we did nothing, there is a built-in expansion in the Affordable Care Act that we had no control over. And that is that the qualifications to receive Medicaid treatment and the full benefit package of Medicaid has already taken place for a group of people who qualify, who didn't qualify before, but who now qualify. And that will also be an item for our budget, and has been an item of our budget, and that is that we are now covering people at the expanded rate that were not covered before, which comes out to be somewhere around $25 to $30 million a year, which is, for most of our budgets, quite a bit of money. Hmm. So it isn't that the issue is ignored. There are some built-in safety nets, such as the one I just explained. And so the debate will go on, and I have great faith that we will do something very, very good and beneficial for our citizens.
We just have a few minutes left. I want to turn to education. We'll start with Senator Knutson on this one. Several bills on education. There was an increase in per pupil funding and several other funding mechanisms. Senator Knutson, what do you think about the education budget? Is this sufficient?
Well, you know, Utah has, and we talk about this continually, and that is that we have the largest families in the country. We love our children. I see no indication that we're going to change direction on our families. And so there is a challenge. We're always faced with funding larger numbers of children than most states in our country. And we, I believe, work very diligently every session to try to do our best. The one issue that we always have to deal with, and that is funding the cost of expansion of enrollees. In other words, each year there's an increase in new students. And one of the first things that we do in putting our budget together is fund for that growth. The other thing that we do is to try to increase the value of the weighted pupil unit. And we did that this year again, as we have done in years past. Are we perfect? Oh, my goodness, no. We're a long ways from perfect. But you take it one step at a time. which I know is frustrating for a lot of folks. They'd like to see us solve it instantly and move on to something else. But this isn't the kind of an issue that you can easily put your arms around and solve. But we do, I think, an admirable job each year. And this year, I think we realized that if there was to be a technology expansion, as had been proposed, then funding for other aspects of education would have not been able to be met. They would have been harmed. So I believe that the speaker did the right thing when she decided not to pursue the $100 to $200 million technology project. It isn't that we don't support technology. We do support technology. Utah is one of the most technological savvy states in the country. And that's one of the reasons why we continue to attract new businesses continuously. So it isn't that we haven't done anything, but we know there's huge challenges yet to overcome.
I want to give Senator Davis a chance to respond on education, but I want to get a caller in first. This is Carl in St. George. Carl, glad you called. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Well, I want to revert back to the expansion of Medicaid. Would that be all right?
That'd be fine.
Okay. I'm at work, so I don't have the exact figures with me, but some 5 or 6 months ago, the Salt Lake Tribune had an article that when the expansion of Medicaid was proposed, the state spent something like $100,000 or $200,000 to do a study to see what kind of direction the state should take with this proposal of expansion of Medicaid. The study came back, and it was reported that the state, if they would expand Medicaid in within 10 years, they could save some, $3 or $4 million in doing it. Now, my question is this. When the state spends this kind of money to get a study by some reputable Eastern firm that tells them which direction to go, why all of this controversy? Why on earth is the governor, and he's the one I wanted to talk to, why is he embarking on this cockamamie fool's errand to go back to Washington to try to propose something else when all he needed to do was follow the state, follow the study. First year, or first 4 years, I think the federal government picks up 50% of the cost, and after that they pick up 90% of the cost. I mean, how much better does it get? And what are you guys doing? You're trying to reinvent the wheel. Why? Why did you spend the money on the study in the first place if you're not going to follow the recommendations of it?
Okay, Carl, thanks for the question. Let me direct this first to Senator Davis.
Thank you, and thanks to the caller down there in St. George. I really believe that we should have followed the study. I think the study was very well done. But even the governor's task force, which was charged of looking at that study and created the study and then the report back, they actually came up with 3 or 4 different ideas to follow after that study. Now, I'm probably biased because I believe we should be doing full expansion in the state of Utah. I think we should be taking those our dollars back, the tax dollars back. They aren't the state's dollars. These are dollars that every individual in the state of Utah has sent to Washington. And this is just money coming back to us for a good care program. And so I believe that, at the end of the day, we may get there, but I think there's a learning curve on how we get there and why it's so important to move forward in that direction. The report itself indicated that it is economic development. And we have to remember that all of these dollars coming back in Medicaid, whether we get it back in a 70-30 split or a 90-10 split, that all of that 90 or that 70 is new money back to the state into our economy. And it grows our economy. Mm. It's not a drag on the economy. So I'm hopeful that when the governor goes back and tries to negotiate what he wants to negotiate, that at the end of the day we do come back and we say, full expansion is really where we need to be.
We do have House leaders on the line. We'll get to them very briefly. I want to give Senator Knutson finally a chance to respond to Carl's concerns.
Well, I appreciate the gentleman calling in, and he brings up a very good point. And I don't have an excellent answer for it, I do know that from both the efforts of the task force and the members of the House and the members of the Senate and the governor have all worked and struggled to find the best answer to this. You know, we have been shown time and time again that federal promises are not always kept. And that is a thing that concerns us. And I think the Affordable Care Act is a beautiful example of promises that sounded marvelous and then never came to fruition, such as families being able to keep their own physician or choosing their own plan if they want to keep it. Well, a lot of those things just never came to be. People lost their insurance in this healthcare experiment, and they weren't truthful when they brought this forth to the citizens of our country. So we have some hesitation when it comes to the promises that they make of what this program will do. We have to look beyond those target dates that are in place. What happens if they don't carry forth? It's on our shoulders. If you expand Medicaid, which we have to by the law that's in place now, if federal support drops off, it's still on our lap to raise taxes to be able to afford what they call the Affordable Care Act, which to me is an interesting acronym. And that's about it. I think it's a huge challenge, and we're working on it, and we'll continue to work on it. And if we can find some stability in the federal government, maybe that will help.
We'll leave it there with our Senate leaders. We thank very much Senator Gene Davis, Senate Minority Leader, and Senate Majority Assistant Whip Peter Knudsen. Thank you, gentlemen, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will go directly now to House leaders. We welcome in House Speaker Rebecca Lockhart. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Appreciate you taking the time, especially after late night last night. House Minority
sure.
Assistant Whip Rebecca Chavez-Houck is with us as well. Thank you.
Good morning.
Let's pick up that thread with Medicaid directly, beginning with Speaker Lockhart. There were concerns, especially in the House. Governor Herbert expressed to me earlier in the program that he's going to go back, negotiate, come back with the best deal he can get. He is hopeful that he can convince, especially Republicans in the House. Do you think prospects are good, Speaker?
You know, it's hard to tell at this point. I will tell you that personally, I'll express some of the reservations that Senator Knudsen just mentioned, which are that, our federal partner, if you can call the federal government in this case a partner, is very unreliable. And what we're talking about is a irreversible decision. Once we decide to go down this path, it will be irreversible. And so we have to be prepared as the taxers in the state of Utah, potentially, to pick up the entire cost of this program. There are a lot of promises made by the federal government. Those promises are not always kept. So we have to go into this thing with eyes wide open. And I personally have very little trust in the federal government's ability to continue to fund Medicaid at the level that they've promised. And I'm trying to make decisions that are about the long-term future of the taxpayers of Utah.
Representative Chavez-Houck, what's your argument here? How are you going to go about to convincing your colleagues on Medicaid expansion?
Well, I think that time will tell when we start to see some of our neighboring states like Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, all of whom have Republican governors who have opted for the Medicaid expansion, and notably not without challenges. Arizona's governor ran into challenges with her legislature and immediately started vetoing some of their bills to kind of reduce the stalemate there. I'm glad we didn't get to that kind of a situation here in Utah. But there are a number of Republican governors that have moved forward with that, notably to address concerns, especially in rural counties where oftentimes they are the folks on the front lines in terms of trying to take care of people who have no insurance, or addressing concerns related to uncompensated care. But I'm anxious to see what happens in those other states, to see if they're able to stem the tide of challenges that occur when you have people that are going to the emergency rooms and are costing all of us who are insurance payers, health insurance, you know, through our premiums. You know, people pay for uncompensated care one way or another. So I'm hopeful to see what happens in those neighboring states. I think that that'll be an indicator of what we could possibly expect if we move forward with the expansion. And notably, I think we also need to look specifically at Medicaid. I know that there have been challenges with other federal granting programs. I know the speaker has had concerns with the PILT funds in particular. But when I look at Medicaid in particular, I think the federal government has met its promises in this regard of this 40-year-plus program where they have not reneged on their commitment to provide Utah, in particular, you know, the 70% match that we've come to expect from them, and many people have benefited from the program. Reminding folks that oftentimes people don't stay on the program for very long. It's often a stopgap to get them through some troubling and challenging times. Maybe they've run into a challenge with medical bankruptcy. Maybe they've been impacted by an unexpected health concern that takes them down and they're not able to continue work for a while. So I think as a stopgap, it's something we need to consider. And also, many of our neighboring states, our Republican states that have done this, have included a circuit breaker, which would, you know, try the program out for a few years. And as we have done in the past, sometimes we've had to say no if the monies aren't there. But I would like to add also that when we were looking at Medicaid expansion last year, I actually ran some legislation to see if we could explore that. I had intended that the savings that we would reap. As indicated through the public consulting group cost-benefit analysis, that we take that money and put it in a Medicaid-restricted account so in the future, 10 years down the road, we'd be able to handle our portion of the cost.
We do had a caller. Didn't want to go on the air, but hopefully I'll express the question well. I'll direct this first to Speaker Lockhart. The caller is concerned about the tax penalty you have to pay if you don't have insurance. $95 or 1% of your income, and people are, you know, realizing that 1% of some incomes is a pretty steep penalty. And this caller is concerned, what about people below the poverty level still perhaps having to pay that penalty? Speaker Lockhart.
Yeah, as I understand the Affordable Care Act, there is a certain income level at which the penalty is not imposed, and that is those very income levels. So the penalty applies, as I understand it, to higher income levels, not the lower.
Okay. I want to fit in a couple more topics here, and we just have about 5 minutes left, so ask everyone to be brief. But Representative Chavez-Houck, what about this question, the tax penalty, especially for people who are, you know, on the poorer side?
Again, as Speaker Lockhart mentioned, there are people that who can express challenges if they are in a certain bracket. They are not going to be impeded so much by the penalty. You know, what I am heartened by, though, Tom, is that we have 39,000 new folks in Utah since October, when the ACA, although with some difficulty, started opening healthcare.gov. But we've had 39,000 people who did not have health insurance before who have tried to use the private market to get themselves covered. But again, the challenge we're going to have is with the donut hole and with these people that don't qualify for either subsidies. They don't make enough to get into the private market immediately and just need some health care coverage. And I hope that with the Health Reform Task Force, we can take some of the ideas that were discussed during the session. The hard work that we did all last summer, both within the task force and in the Medicaid working group, and come to a resolution soon, because people need coverage.
On to address education, Speaker Lockhart, I'm curious about the principles behind, the impetus behind your ambitious education technology plan, which ultimately was not successful. What were you going for there? What will be lost since that didn't pass?
Sure. So although it wasn't, you know, nothing specific came forward this session, the vision is there. We all know that this is where education is and where it will be, and we will go there. The question is when.
when we are going to be able to invest the resources to really make it happen for our children. Technology is how education is being delivered and will be delivered in the future. And so what we've got to do is we've got to invest first in the infrastructure in all of our school buildings and then in our teachers. We have to invest in the professional development for our teachers so that they can use technology in ways that enhance learning and that enable learning. And the device is at the back end. The device is just a tool. If you don't have the infrastructure, if you don't have the teachers trained, then the device is meaningless. And so that's really what this initiative was about. Was about the infrastructure and about the professional development, and then down the road leading to the device. But that will continue on. We have the Education Task Force that was reauthorized that will meet another year, which both myself and the Senate President are the chairs of that. I plan to bring that forward throughout the summer so that we have a good vetting of that initiative, and it's my opinion that will come forward again in the next session. I won't personally be there, but many members of the legislature, specifically Representative Gibson, who's the House chair of the Education Committee, is committed to continue to work on that and move that forward. As I said, this will happen. This is where education is going. The question is, will we have the wherewithal as Utahns to lead or to follow? And I've always believed that Utah should lead. So I'm very very positive about the direction that we're headed there, and I think it's just going to, you know, take a little time, but we'll get there, and hopefully sooner rather than later.
Representative Chavez-Houck, we only have about a minute left. The top priority for education for you?
You know, we were happy to see that we were able to get the weighted pupil unit covered. There were still some challenges related to teacher compensation that we wish could have been addressed a little bit more ardently. But I think that in general, we were able to assure that our schools and our teachers have the foundational needs, their foundational needs met. You know, I have to say that I agree with Speaker Lockhart in that we need to be able to move into a 21st century modality related to what tools our students and teachers have at their disposal. But our continued challenge with our increasing enrollment and the number of students that we have in our school system is always making sure that the foundation is strong. You can't, in my mind, it's like, doing a refurbishing of a home and putting brand new things into your home when you don't have a good foundation. So as she mentions, infrastructure is key. And support for teachers to be able to respond to changing technologies is important, but there are also very basic foundational needs in terms of assistance for our ESL kids, for our changing demographics, et cetera, that also continually need to be addressed.
Well, we're out of time. As you mentioned, made reference to, I think, Speaker Lockhart, you're retiring, Representative Selig retiring as well. So thank you for your service. Thanks for appearing
Thanks
on the
so
program
much.
Today. Representative Chavez-Houck, I believe you'll be back, right, running for re-election?
I'll be back, but I do want to take a quick second to thank Speaker Lockhart for her service on the Hill and also for her openness with our minority caucus. I've served under three different speakers, and I have to say that Speaker Lockhart has been the one that has been the most open. She allows open communication to occur between our two caucuses and understands and appreciates the expertise and the information that our caucus provides to provide good public policy.
Well, thank you both for being on the program. Thanks to everyone who participated. Thanks for calling in. For producer Shalane Smith-Edom, I'm Tom Williams. Thanks so much for listening today.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Utah Public Radio would like to thank this year's sponsors of our 2014 legislative coverage, AARP Utah and Utah State University Center for Women and Gender.